This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Barack Obama's bowling misadventures and remarks about bitter voters, Hillary Clinton's whiskey shots and gun stories, John McCain's family money. Once again, a presidential campaign has come to who's elite and who isn't. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg explains the history of the E-word and its cultural evolution.
People are always splitting off new meanings for words, but every once in a while they'll smush together two old ones. As with other kinds of inbreeding, the process can produce monsters. Take the curious recent development of the noun elite. Until not long ago, it was a barely nativized French word that still wore a jaunty, acute accent on its E. Now it's a word that can drive items like Iraq and immigration to the bottom of the network's debate agenda. Elite used to have two distinct meanings. It could be a la-di-da word for the upper crust, what people used to call the bon ton. Or more consequentially, it could denote the interlocking command structure of society that the sociologist C. Wright Mills referred to in the title of his classic 1956 book, The Power Elite. As Mills described them, those were the people who rule the big corporations, run the machinery of the state, and direct the military establishment. Until a few decades ago, the two senses of elite rarely even nodded to each other. The first appeared only in the society pages and the names of pastry shops. The second showed up only in political dispatches and sociology journals. The blurring of those two senses was first audible in the 1960s when Spiro Agnew first put the phrase media elite into wide circulation and joined it with descriptions like effete snobs, which suggested the social meaning of the word. But the new meaning of elite didn't really start to emerge until the summer of 1992, when Vice President Dan Quayle sparked a national controversy by denouncing Candace Bergen's TV character Murphy Brown for having a child out of wedlock. Quayle put the blame on a cultural elite who were mocking ordinary Americans in newsrooms, sitcom studios, and faculty lounges all over America. "We have two cultures," he said, "the cultural elite and the rest of us." Those attacks weren't sufficient to save the Bush-Quayle ticket in the fall elections, but they did put the E-word at the center of national attention. When he was asked who exactly made up the cultural elite, Quayle answered coyly, "They know who they are." But Newsweek obligingly provided a list of its 100 most prominent members, which even-handedly included both poster-child liberals like Bill Moyers, Frank Rich, and Oprah, and conservatives like William Bennett, George Will, and Lynn Cheney. By any reasonable measure of cultural influence, those were all uncontroversial calls. But by then, the noun elite had been sent spinning inexorably leftward. It wasn't just that it was now exclusively prefixed by liberal and that it suggested a seditious taste in cheese and beverages. Even the job descriptions of the elite had changed, so that the qualifier cultural had come to seem redundant. In the British media, you still see elite used predominantly to refer to economic and business leaders, whether you look at the left-wing Guardian or Rupert Murdoch's Times of London. But on Murdoch's Fox News, references to the media elite outnumber references to the business and corporate elite by 40-1. And the disproportion is only slightly less dramatic on CNN. When Americans hear elite these days, they're less likely to think of the managers and politicians who inhabit the corridors of power than of the celebrities, academics, and journalists who lodge in its outer boroughs. It remained only for the noun elite to undergo its final democratization, where it was emptied of its last connections to social position or to actual wealth or power. All that was left of its original meanings was the implication of insufferable pretension and an unwarranted sense of entitlement. As the conservative radio host Laura Ingraham explains it in her book Shut Up and Sing, elite Americans are defined not so much by class or wealth or position as they are by a general outlook. Their core belief is that they're superior to we the people. They think we're stupid. They think where we live is stupid. They think our SUVs are stupid. They think our guns are stupid. That broadened meaning of elite can create some confusion for liberals who haven't quite cottoned to it. They're apt to get indignant when they hear elite pronounced with a sneer by people who would have unquestionably qualified for the label under its traditional definition. And they may be puzzled by the expansive use of we that modern critics of elites tend to fall into when they're talking about non-elite Americans. How does a Connecticut-raised, Ivy-educated lawyer like Ingraham get to share a first-person plural pronoun with a working-class deer hunter from western Pennsylvania? For that matter, what are we supposed to make of that pronoun we when we hear the quintessential blue state conservative David Brooks asking, Is Barack Obama somebody who doesn't know anything about the way the American people actually live? Or does he actually get the way we live? I mean, if you give Brooks that we, who's the they supposed to be? But then if you don't have to have money, power, or influence to qualify as elite, it follows that having those things doesn't necessarily disqualify you from being one of the rest of us, so long as you can knock back a shot occasionally and don't stop channeling your inner G-dropper. The crucial thing, as Barack Obama learned, is not to be caught seeming to be out of touch, a phrase that Google News paired with his name in more than 3,500 stories after the Bittergate episode. Some are wherever you like, but if you don't want to be described as elite, you'd better know who Dale Earnhardt Jr. is.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.